It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at Chicago's Cabrini Green Housing Project and hear the human stories and history behind the rise and fall of the nation's most controversial projects. First, President Trump said yesterday that his administration will impose new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. The announcement had an immediate effect. The Dow Jones fell by about 500 points ahead of closing yesterday afternoon, and world markets opened sharply lower, some turbulence still today. The president defended the decision on Twitter this morning, saying foreign steel was hurting the domestic industry and that, quote, trade wars are good and easy to win, end quote. A number of his fellow Republicans have raised concerns about the decision, including Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Give us a quick 101. What changes under the president's announcement yesterday?
The short version is I wish I had good news, but it's bad economic policy. It's bad foreign policy. It might have broader implications. Specifically, what we're talking about is Trump announced that there are going to be 25% across the board tariffs on imported steel and 10% on aluminum.
And these are across the board. I'm going to jump in. I understand that there have been specific targeted increased tariffs on certain kinds of Chinese steel, saying, hey, you're selling this too cheap. We're imposing specific, almost punitive tariffs on these. This is different.
Yes, right. So as we've spoken about in the past, and as the Bush administration did in 2002, the U.S. has, I believe, over 100 different types of tariffs on Chinese steel and other countries' steel where you're targeting this specific product is being dumped into the U.S. market or it's being illegally subsidized. This is different. This is the Trump administration saying, for national security reasons, we're going to have an across-the-board tariff on all steel and all aluminum.
That's the justification being used here on the International Court of Public Opinion, the national security angle. The idea, as I understand it, is, okay, suppose we're in another World War II situation. We need to produce lots of military hardware. If our foreign supplies of steel and aluminum are disrupted or if we're at war with one of our suppliers, say, we need to make sure we're still producing enough to do something like that.
Yes, and this is, frankly, this is the oldest argument for trade protection going back centuries. Mm-hmm. The British used to make this argument about food and why we can't import food from France, right? There's a law from the Cold War era, Section 232 in U.S. law that allows us to do this. And in the law of the treaty of the forerunner to the World Trade Organization, the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, way back when the GATT was founded in 1947, there's a clause that says you can impose trade protection for national security reasons. It's never really been invoked. Right. And the danger and risk is it's a slippery slope that other countries could use as well. The empirical aspect of it, which is troubling, is most of our steel, right, doesn't come from countries that we might have conflicts with. Right, our largest trading partner in terms of steel and imports is Canada. After that, it's Brazil, South Korea, Mexico. So the justification is national security, but the countries that are going to be hit are actually some of our closest trading partners and democratic allies.
Do you think that national security is the real reason here, or is this an economic policy decision?
I think it's a political justification for a policy that Trump's views on trade policy have been what they are now, going back decades. He used to talk about Japan the way he now talks about China, that we are losing, that they are winning, and so I think it's a very instrumental excuse to impose trade protection. The risk, aside from the economic issues, the risk is that other countries could do this, and it's a huge loophole, right? If you start to say, well, China's dumping this product and we're going to impose a specific tariff on that product, that's one thing, and other countries might retaliate. But if we justify national security for across-the-board tariffs, then the European Union can do that, the Canadians can do that, the Chinese can do that. It's a really huge threat to the multilateral trade regime in the global economy.
If I'm another country, I could say, well, grain, cheese, these are things that a global crisis could cut the supply of. We're going to stop. We're going to put a tariff on American exports of these things.
Yeah. And again, this is what happens all the time in World Trade Organization cases, that the U.S. imposes anti-dumping duties against the European Union on certain products, and then the EU will come back and say, all right, we're going to target Kentucky bourbon or we're going to target cheese from Wisconsin, and you get these sort of narrow back and forth tit for tat type of things. But that's very different from, you know, the world of the 1930s and the Great Depression, where what you had was across the board tariffs, and you get into these beggar thy neighbor policies. And what happened then was the global economy came crashing down. And that's the big medium-term risk.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, we're looking at President Trump's announcement of tariffs on steel and aluminum. You're raising a concern there about a trade war. Here's a tweet from the president. This was this morning, I think. When a country, parentheses USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win, that bit underlined. Example, when we're down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore, we win big, it's easy. Trade wars are good and easy to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you saw the same tweets
that I did this morning. So the problem with that, and this is how Trump has always thought about trade, is that there's problems with bilateral deficits. Right, that if you are running a trade deficit, a surplus with me, I'm losing and you're winning. The other way to think about this, and the way we normally think about international trade, is we both get something out of international trade. Right, I get imports, you get exports, we get increased consumption. The really big problem now is American consumers and American producers use imported steel. Right. So what is this going to do if you cut off trade, right, or you increase the cost of imported steel and aluminum? Well, everything that we buy, right, is going to be more expensive. Toyota has already announced that their cars are going to be more expensive because the inputs of production are now going to be more expensive, even the Toyotas that are produced in the United States. And I saw another tweet by a small business owner in Wisconsin yesterday, where he basically said, I buy steel from the Netherlands because it is a specialized type of steel and it's the only producer in the world who makes that type of steel, right? So if you're thinking about certain types of steel are produced in lots of countries and we might protect jobs, right, by shifting consumption towards domestic steel. But there are some aluminum products and some steel products that American producers don't produce, but other American manufacturing firms and corporations actually use as inputs. All of that is more expensive. All of that is going to get passed on to consumers, or much of that in the form of increased prices.
These tariffs have gotten some supporters. The AFL-CIO leadership, the union, is saying this is good, about time, our workers need this. We've seen some Democrats in Ohio and elsewhere saying this is good, this is going to help steel workers. There are some people who will benefit from this in the United States, right?
In the short term, right? And unclear for how long. Right. So as you know, we've spoken about before on previous shows, right, you're going to protect jobs in certain sectors, but the cost to a much broader swath of society is going to be there. And so the numbers I saw yesterday were that steel using industries employ 80 times more people as steel producing industries. Right. So you're going to save some jobs. Right. But you might actually have some of those small businesses go out of business because now they have increased costs. The net effects are unclear. And again, if we get into this sort of international trade war and you think about the cost of other things going up, then the net benefit for any individual in the economy is a little unclear.
Let's talk about trade and foreign policy for a moment. Outside of the economic side of this, this is a relationship building exercise. As you mentioned, Canada, the biggest exporter of steel and aluminum to the United States, the biggest loser, presumably, from these tariffs. What does this do to alliances with countries like Canada, to relationships with countries like Mexico and Brazil?
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's the direct economic harm, right, in terms of we are hitting, right, some of our closest allies directly in terms of their exports and their trade relationships with us. But there's a broader strategic issue, right? Trade policy is actually foreign policy. And so if you think about what has happened now over the last year, the Trump administration withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a Pacific Rim trade agreement with some of our major allies, Japan, Mexico, Canada, et cetera. And now you're talking about steel and aluminum tariffs that are going to hit Canada and Mexico and Brazil and South Korea. These are some of our largest trading partners. They're also our major democratic allies, right, around the world. And if you think about what's also going on with transatlantic trade tensions, Trump is, you know, there was going to be a US-EU trade agreement. Trump is also openly questioning our commitment to NATO. So a lot of the rhetoric is we're doing this because of China, right? And this is going to punish China. But the economic and political impact is really on our allies, and it also undermines American credibility. Right. So if you're doing these sorts of things, you're also casting doubt on our commitment to the global trade regime and whether or not we're going to pull out from the WTO, whether we're going to honor those sorts of trade commitments.
Let's talk about China for a moment. The accusation in an industry like steel is that China produces a ton of steel, more now than their domestic market, as I understand it, can handle. They want to sell it. They're selling it cheap. They're dumping it is the word people use. That's really hurting the American steel industry. Is there a case to be made for more targeted tariffs toward China?
Those are already there, right? Those are the, as I said before, there's over 100 different types of duties that we have on foreign steel. A lot of that is China. And again, China is the 11th largest exporter of steel to the United States, right? So we are hitting 75% of the steel that is not China and countries that are smaller exporters. So it's not clear that these new policies are actually going to have the desired effect. The broader problem is overcapacity. I mean, look, I grew up in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, which is an old steel town where the Bethlehem steel plant closed in the early 1980s. There has been overcapacity of steel production in the global economy since the 1970s and 1980s, and there's a long-term trend. And these types of duties probably aren't going to change that. Maybe on the margin, they're going to save a few jobs and they're going to keep some steel plants in the U.S. open for a little bit longer. But there are long-term structural changes in the global economy, and the U.S. has shifted away from a, you know, steel-producing, auto-producing type of economy. And, you know, what we haven't done in the United States is actually implement domestic policies to compensate and retrain workers. Those jobs are going away. They're probably going to continue to go away even with trade protection. And this is sort of pushing against a much broader long-term trend.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me again.
Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about President Trump's announcement that he wants to impose a tariff on aluminum and steel. The Cabrini Green high-rises once housed 15,000 people on Chicago's Near North Side, a public housing project that came to symbolize public housing for both the city and the country. The buildings became notorious for crime and drug activity and bad living conditions. By 2011, the last of the buildings had been demolished. Ben Austin wrote about the projects in his new book, High-Risers, Cabrini Green and the Fate of American Public Housing. He joins us now. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, these projects, Cabrini Green, were a symbol of despair in many ways when they came down. They were a symbol of hope when they went up and an amazing improvement in living conditions for a lot of people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this was, you know, when these were built, the proof that the private market couldn't build housing for the poor and for the working class was just obvious in homeless shelters, in eviction riots, in cities that were covered with blight, and in houses that were completely unfit for habitation.
Right, and some of the people and some of the stories you recount in your book, it's people moving from places that were fire traps, falling down almost literally, overpriced along the way, plaster and paint falling into the food, and unheated or maybe heated with a little coal burner, I think. Cabrini Green was like paradise compared to that.
Yeah, and it's great that you said the word paradise, because one of the things that comes up again and again with interviews of early residents, they're describing it as heaven or as paradise or as something godly, meaning the damnation of its absence before, that just a basic rudimentary home feels like deliverance. You know, that you're safe in your house, that it's orderly and decent and new, and even that there's a government agency that you could call when you have a problem rather than the landlord whom, you know, might as well put you out rather than fix something.
Cabrini Green was a powerful symbol in a good way maybe then, in a bad way toward the end. In your book, though, you kind of remind us that it wasn't just a symbol. There were people living their lives, all of their lives in some cases, in this project. What were you trying to show here?
Yeah, so it's an intimate portrait of people who made homes in this place that was a symbol, that was infamous, that was a sort of horror story version of life. But there were real people and a rich fabric of life there. sometimes in spite of real traumatic situations, and sometimes really just separate from that. I mean, in an area of 15 to 20,000 people, you have all kinds of lives going on. One of the things I write about is the horror movie Candyman, which is set at Cabrini Green in the 90s. And, you know, when you think about how horror works, it's imagining the terrible thing in that space that you can't see, and that everything, you know, in the thing that you can't see, it must also be terrible and horrible. And that was really what this was like, you know, sort of, you know, writing off the entire place as a horror story, and therefore, you know, a lot of that hardening into actual policy, which ends up removing people. And even if a place like that needed to be better, you know, it almost guaranteed that the people who live there wouldn't gain from the moves.
A running thread through your book, as you follow the stories of a group of people, different individuals in Cabrini Green, was they didn't really have much control over the place they lived, and a lot of people tried to change that and became housing activists to say, hey, if we had a stake here, if we had a say here, things might not be so bad. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, like, all of our lives are controlled by forces larger than us, and I think when you're poor, and especially on, say, government aid, even more so. You know, that these larger forces make determinations that suddenly, you know, radical shifts in your life. You know, something that is decided in Washington suddenly means that you have to leave your home. And, you know, residents did have a lot of agency at the same time. They had elected tenant councils. They organized. One of the things I see is that, you know, so even beyond public housing is almost a way to talk about our uneasiness with poverty, you know, throughout the history of this country. So, I mean, I write about Cabrini Green, I write about Chicago, but it's really about our past in every city and as a country, and about our present. And you know, we get rid of public housing, and we used to literally own this problem, and now it's almost more invisible, and the, you know, people have less agency by because of it.
Talking to Ben Austin, his new book is High Risers, Cabrini Green and the Fate of American Public Housing. Speaking tonight, by the way, at 6 in Madison at A Room of One's Own bookstore. Ben, this is also a story of race. And yeah, from the beginning, if a black person attempted to move into a white neighborhood or get a job that was seen as a white job, they were met with violence. I mean, not just discrimination, but actual bombs and violence. Talk about that part of the story of how this particular solution of public housing happened.
Yeah, as dire as housing conditions were for everyone in Chicago in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they were much worse for African Americans. They were barred from the open housing market. They couldn't get government loans. They couldn't move into neighborhoods. So they needed the intervention of government more than anybody, you know, to find a decent home. You know, and I talked about the uneasiness of poverty, and, you know, often in the country we conflate that with race. In Chicago, and this is true of elsewhere also, that the public housing was placed only in existing black slums because of whites who rioted at the idea that public housing might bring integration.
Are there lessons we can learn today from Cabrini Green?
No doubt. I mean, I think about where we are right now as a country, and even the incredible inequality that we have in this country, and even sort of our you know, our fears of race, and even kind of the fear-mongering of Chicago, which I'm hearing from the President of the United States, which feels a lot like how Cabrini Green was talked about throughout its existence. When public housing was being demolished, when high-rise public housing was being demolished, the evil that was talked about was concentrated poverty and isolation, and it would only be benefit to get rid of that. So you're seeing in places like Chicago, we still have concentrated poverty and isolation. And if you know, if you're hearing about Chicago now, it's often about for things like gun violence. We have a lot of these same problems. We're not wrestling with them. We're not looking for the correct solutions. I know even here, you know, that in the legislature, there was just sort of passing some new restrictions on social safety net programs. This is also a rural problem, that if you lose affordable housing in a rural area, there is no other option. You have to basically move. There's no other place to go.
That reminds me of one kind of symbolic moment in your book. One of the designers of one of the Cabrini Green buildings had this fancy-looking sign with the address on it, in metal, I think. And it was actually cheaper than a lot of the alternatives. And whoever's in charge said, no, it looks too fancy. We don't want this public housing thing to look like it was at all expensive.
Yeah. What,
is that symbolic, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, sort of this trickiness of having to provide something for the poor, but only to make it just so. You know, then as now, meaning then even back in the 30s and 40s, we still had this uneasiness, and there was incredible opposition to the idea of public housing. That's moved much further into the mainstream, and so we're still wrestling with that for sure.
We haven't focused much on the individual stories in your book, but as people looked back on life in Cabrini Green, obviously there were bad things they remembered. Was there some sense of a positive nostalgia along with that?
Oh, completely. I mean, one of the first things you hear from almost any resident is we knew everyone. We were like family. And you built up these networks often by necessity. And, you know, to be poor in public housing and to have these networks and family and then to be poor elsewhere in the city without them is much worse. You've lost these support networks, which formed over years.
We'll leave it there. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, so A Room of One's Own tonight at 6. Thank you.
That's Ben Austin. He joined us to talk about his new book, High Risers, Cabrini Green, and the Fate of American Public Housing. As you just heard, he is speaking tonight in Madison at 6 at A Room of One's Own bookstore. Baking is both an art and a science. You got to have the right ingredients, use them correctly, and monitor that baked good as it's there in the oven. And a lot of us might skip out on baking altogether for fear of getting it wrong. But our Food Friday guest says baking can not only be fun and rewarding, it can be relatively stress-free. Erin Jean McDowell is a baker and the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've never met, Erin, but you start your book describing me exactly. Like, I feel comfortable with a lot of kinds of cooking. I know how I can wing it with different things, but not baking. I'm worried that it's so fussy that sometimes I just don't bother. And you tell me at the beginning, I can and should go bake right now. Why?
Absolutely. I totally understand why baking scares a lot of people, because there's not that same kind of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants vibe that cooking has, where you can kind of just add a little bit of this or a little of that. But if you understand kind of what's going on behind a recipe, suddenly it becomes much easier to kind of tweak your baking recipes, and baking can actually be very flexible.
And that's part of what I love about your book. You give some basics behind the processes, but in most of the recipes, you've got a why it works section. Why is it important for us to understand that why it works part of the recipe?
Oh, that's my favorite part of the whole book, every single why it works, because in those little tidbits, I'm basically explaining the science in just a sentence or two, not enough to bog you down and make you think, oh God, I have to understand chemistry to understand this recipe, but just enough to sort of say, oh, I couldn't replace sugar with honey in this case, and this is why.
Yeah, and you open the book actually with some stuff that answers some of my long-term baking questions. I do bake some stuff, and I find that sometimes when I put in, say, whole wheat flour instead of the all-purpose flour, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and there's properties of whole wheat flour that work differently. Can you talk about that just as an example?
Yes, absolutely. Well, different flours absorb moisture differently. So the biggest issue that a lot of people have is actually thinking that they can substitute a whole wheat flour for something like an all-purpose flour equally. Because the truth is, just because of the nature of having the bran and the germ inside the whole wheat flour when it's ground, it's going to absorb more moisture. It's going to need more to create a similar texture to something that was made with all-purpose flour. So you can use it, but you often need to make just like a couple of quick adjustments. And what I tell people at home, now that it's more readily available in lots of grocery stores, there's something called whole wheat pastry flour. And that can actually be used as a pretty equal sub in many cases for all-purpose flour, because it has a lower protein content, so it absorbs moisture a little bit more similarly to all-purpose.
And that's the first life lesson I'm going to take home from your book. Another basic tip that applies kind of across the board, you have a page on getting our ingredients to room temperature before we start baking. Why?
Well, when your ingredients are at room temperature, you're more easily to make basically an emulsion. So think about it a little bit like you're making a vinaigrette. When you make a vinaigrette, you know, you need to gradually add the oil in because the oil and the vinegar don't want to mix. Well, that same kind of thing can happen in baking. If you're mixing, just one example is a lot of people do use room temperature butter, but then they take their eggs right out of the fridge. And by adding cold eggs to a cookie dough that has warm butter, it's more likely to break the mixture, and basically you're not going to have this kind of homogeneous, even dough. And it might still turn out okay, but a lot of times you can follow a recipe exactly and kind of skip that little step, and it can really make a big difference.
And how about softening that butter? I've learned the hard way that softening doesn't mean heat it to till it's liquid.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my favorite trick for softening butter, because I often forget myself even to leave some out on the counter, and this time of year, if it's really cold, it can take a long time. So I actually put it in the microwave, still in the wrapper of the, you know, the butter paper, and I put it in for 10 seconds and then turn it on its side and do another 5 seconds, and I usually find that that brings it perfectly to room temperature.
Talking to Erin Jean McDowell, her new book is The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice for your cookies and pastries and other baked goods? Call in at 800-642-1234 or share your favorites. We've got a few of your recipes that you've shared with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page and WPR.org/Food Friday. This one is from your home state of Kansas, I understand, sweet corn cakes.
Yes.
Tell us about the end product. I'm not sure what I'm visualizing here.
So I love cornbread, and there's not actually any savory recipes in my book, and I actually get into a fight sometimes because when I was growing up, my mom liked to make cornbread a little bit on the sweeter side. She would have some sugar in it. She would also serve it with honey, which was my favorite thing as a kid. We would have that with chili or all sorts of different kinds of things. And I would serve that to some of my friends once I moved away from home. And I had several friends who said, oh, well, cornbread shouldn't be sweet. So by calling it a corn cake, then there's that understanding that it's going to be sweet. And then I do that same thing that my mom did, which is drizzle honey over it. And in Kansas in the summer, the corn is just so sweet. To me, it tastes like candy. And it's something that I love so much. And so I sort of love using it in a dessert instead of kind of just buttering it and eating it on its own, which is, of course, also delicious.
The knock on cornbread is that some people think it's usually too dry. Is
yes.
that do you get around that in your sweet corn cakes?
That's definitely not an issue here, because actually sugar is a liquefier, which means when you're adding sugar to a recipe, it's helping to moisten the overall recipe, and it also helps to keep it from drying out kind of over time. If you make it and you don't eat it the same day that you bake it, if you keep it wrapped in an airtight container, sugar is actually going to kind of prolong the life of the baked good. So the fact that these are cakes and have a little bit more sugar than a standard cornbread, they're definitely nice and moist and really delicious.
And this is basically a quick bread, right? It's not a yeast thing.
Yes, absolutely. And so they're, I bake them sometimes in, you know, in muffin pans and make them kind of individual cakes, but you could also bake it in a loaf pan. You could bake it in a round cake pan. That's another way that I like to tell people that baking is flexible. If you sort of understand a little bit about your end goal, you can kind of make those changes and substitutions, whether you just don't have a piece of equipment or whether you want to make them individual rather than a big size. That's an easy change that you can make with a little bit of planning.
Now, you've got some corn kernels in this, and then you say polenta or very coarse yellow cornmeal. How do we make sure we get the right kind of cornmeal for this?
I actually did test this recipe as well with a finer cornmeal, so it will still work just fine, but I sort of like the texture that polenta gives. It's coarser ground, so you get a little bit more of that kind of nuttiness that is in cornmeal and specifically in polenta. And then I like the corn kernels just to add that actual kind of candy bit, that part that reminds me of summer at home.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Cheryl on the line in Berlin. Cheryl, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Cheryl?
Well, I've been baking for many years, love to bake. My problem is my homemade cakes, they're delicious, but they're always dry, really dry. And, you know, I've added sour cream and stuff, and I don't know, what is the secret to it? And they're, like, heavy, too.
Okay, that could be a couple of things. And for one, it could be the type of cake that you're making. And even though it tastes good, it gets a little bit drier because of the actual ratios of the ingredients. It is a common issue I just mentioned. As much as we sort of all try to not add too much sugar unnecessarily, adding enough sugar is actually something that's really important to keeping the cake being moist, especially after a day or a couple of days. But also, it sounds to me like the problem could be slightly overbaking the cake, just a smidge, because really just a couple extra minutes in the oven can be the difference between the cake being soft and moist and just have a lot of really great flavor and kind of starting to dry out a little unnecessarily.
So Cheryl, a little more sugar, a little shorter baking time, and then just drive them over to the WPR studio and we'll give you our feedback on that. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go now to Stephen on the line in Wauwatosa. Stephen, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I am about to make an attempt at a buttercream frosting, but I found so many different recipes and I don't know which one would work. And I was wondering if I could get some tips on buttercream.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of different kinds of buttercream, and they're all kind of have different end results and also slightly different varying levels of difficulty. So the easiest buttercream out there is called American buttercream, and this is a really simple combination of powdered sugar and butter and then whatever kind of flavor you want. You would basically just combine that in your mixer with your paddle attachment, and you can even do it by hand by mixing vigorously with a silicone spatula or a wooden spoon. My favorite kind of buttercream is Italian buttercream. And the reason it's my favorite, it's a little bit more effort, but the texture is just much lighter than that American buttercream, and it's silky smooth. And the smoother your frosting is, the easier it actually is to get it to look nice on your cake as well. And that's something that I can't deny the power of. So I would highly recommend trying out Italian buttercream.
And so with buttercream, since there's different ways to make it, does that mean, Aaron, that we have a little wiggle room? It's going to be hard to get it too terribly wrong?
You know, buttercreams are relatively forgiving, and most recipes I find nowadays also provide really good visual cues, as well as saying, okay, well, you need to cook this for 2 minutes. It also says, and it should look like this. And so when you're making buttercream, I think if you keep an eye on those visual cues, but it is the one piece of advice I would say is that sometimes buttercreams about halfway through mixing, they start to look almost like they've curdled or they've broken. And that is very normal. It happens. And so you just have to keep mixing it and not be scared. That's where the fearless part comes in.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Jean McDowell. She's a baker and the author of The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about baking? Do you need a diagnosis on something that seems to go wrong for you? Or do you have a favorite recipe to share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find a link to some of Aaron's recipes. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our Food Friday conversation about baking with Erin Jean McDowell. Her new book is The Fearless Baker, Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, the advice you need, or a favorite dish, a favorite thing that you bake, maybe your own advice. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also find a few of Erin's recipes linked on the Ideas Network Facebook page or go right to WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls now. Anissa is with us in Appleton. Anissa, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Anissa?
Yeah, so I have been baking for, you know, quite a few years now, and I kind of come up with a really bad situation whenever I try to bake cakes. They're not light and fluffy. They're pretty dense, more like a muffin, which is, well, great when I'm baking muffins. So I was wondering, do you sift the flour before measuring, or do you measure before you sift the flour, or do you not have to sift flour at all?
That's a great question, and there's sort of a few portions to my answer. So the first thing is, when you're baking, the most accurate way to bake is by measuring by weight. And I know that that is something right there, right off the bat, that scares a lot of people. But what I remind people is, by measuring by weight and using a scale, you don't have to dirty all those little cups and teaspoons. So there's actually less dishes to wash in the end. So there's a plus there. But when you are measuring in a volume measurement, like cup measurements, teaspoon measurements, the best thing to do with dry ingredients is to spoon them in, just using a regular, house spoon, any kind of spoon that you have in your kitchen, and then use kind of the handle of the spoon to level it off. Then from that point, you would sift that amount. That would be the best way to get the most accurate measurement when you're measuring by volume.
Hope that helps, Anissa. Before we go back to more callers, Aaron, I want to check out another one of the recipes you've shared with us, jammy hand pies. So
yes.
These are little pies. I got to say, making pie crust, that's one of those things that intimidates me. That sounds like a toughie.
I hear you. And, I used to make pies with my grandma growing up, and I love making pies, and I love teaching people how to make pies because they have this amazing light bulb moment the first time that they get it right. And the biggest thing that people do with pies is just overwork the dough. And it's they just get a little bit too enthusiastic about the mixing, and that's what makes a pie crust really tough. And that's something that is obviously less desirable when you want that really flaky, tender pie crust going on.
And butter or lard?
Butter all the way. I'm an all butter girl all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Your crust recipe is actually all butter, B-U-T-T-A-H, pie dough, right?
That's right, because I can't say the word butter without having a little bit of like a butter. I just get a little excited by it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Cheryl is with us in Wauwatosa. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do a lot of baking, and I've always wondered, is it okay when you want to cool something fast? Do you set it outside to cool on a cold day, or does that add like more condensation to it, or does it damage the product in any way? And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Well, according to my research, Cheryl, like a cartoon character is likely to come along and steal it off the windowsill. But any other objections, Aaron?
Actually, cooling something outside isn't really a big issue. What I would say is probably better is to cool it in an area that has a draft, by a fan or by an open window. That's where that whole situation of the pie cooling on the windowsill comes from, because you sort of avoid it being too drastic of a temperature change. But the one thing I will recommend not doing is do not attempt to cool something faster by putting it in the refrigerator. It will bring down the temperature of your refrigerator, which is no good for anything else in there. But also the humidity and the other factors of a refrigerator can definitely be negative towards your end result.
But in Wisconsin, a cold winter day, putting it on the back porch, is that going to cool it, too fast somehow?
No, freezing? It shouldn't. In general, like I said, it's better to sort of cool it at a more, to lower the temperature a little bit more steadily. And so putting it shocking outside could be a big change. But definitely if you're just want to throw it out there for 10 minutes to kind of speed up the cooling process, there's going to be no major effect there that's going to give you a super negative end result.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jeff with us in Baraboo. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've just started baking with my granddaughter, and we've been looking at the equipment, if you will. And cake pans seem to be more complicated than they should be. So the question is, what kind of metal, for example, aluminum, anodized aluminum, aluminized steel, and then light versus dark, non-stick, reflective. Is there a very basic but very reliable cake pan by metal, by color?
Yes, absolutely. So I usually recommend people use lighter cake pans in general because they just give you a little bit more consistent results. In general, the darker the pan, the more likely the baked good is also to get dark. So a lighter pan would be my preference. I will admit that I really like nonstick bakeware, especially cake pans, because it just gives you, even when you grease and prepare your cake pan properly, it sort of gives you that extra security that it's going to unmold. And I will even go so far as to say my favorite brand of cake pans kind of across the board is Nordic Ware. They have some that are nonstick and some that are not, if you prefer to go the non-nonstick route. But I really like their pans, and they almost always unmold perfect and clean for me every single time.
Jeff, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. Good luck to you and your granddaughter on your baking project. We're talking to Aaron Jean McDowell, author of The Fearless Baker. Back to your calls now. Andy is with us in Menominee. Andy, hi.
Hi. I had a comment on the type of fan. I know you just kind of covered some of that, but is glass different than steel?
What are you baking, Andy, if I can jump in?
Like a bar, like a 7-layer bar or something
like
that.
Okay, yum.
My mom always used steel. My wife uses glass. I tend to like the steel a little better and put more of a crust on it, it seemed like.
Yes, that can be true. The one situation with glass that I will say is I normally recommend glass pie pans actually for baking pies. The reason being that you can actually kind of look right at your pie and see if the underside is baked properly. But in general, I prefer the results from metal pans. I do occasionally, my mom actually uses a lot of glass pans. And so when I'm home visiting, I bake brownies and things in glass pans. And if you want that little bit of extra crust, you can definitely still get it in the glass pie pan. You may just want to extend the baking time by just a couple of minutes.
Andy, thanks a lot for calling. Good luck with your 7-layer bars. I want to touch on one more recipe you shared with us, a great one for Wisconsin Public Radio. Donuts, yeasted donuts.
Yes.
How do we make these? And we don't need a special, you just have it in deep oil. We don't need a special donut maker for these.
Nope, no special donut maker. In fact, this recipe actually originally came from my great-great-grandmother. It was given to me by my grandma on a recipe card, and I changed a couple of things about it, but the recipe was so good that I pretty much use it as is. And what it is special about this recipe is it does involve yeast, but it's very set it and forget it. You basically mix the dough the night before you want to make the donuts, and then you let it do a slow rise overnight in the refrigerator. So instead of having to worry about whether or not the yeast has risen properly, I promise when you wake up, the dough is going to be ready to go, and that's all it takes.
Let's talk about premeditation here a little, Aaron, because, you know, with yeast, you've got to allow some time. We were talking earlier about getting stuff to room temperature. Baking, it does pay to think ahead at least a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, the biggest baking dilemmas that I address from people asking me questions on a day-to-day basis come as a result that they didn't read the recipe fully before they started. And there may just be that one little tidbit that, you know, will actually make your life easier by reading the whole thing, and you won't miss a step or skip a step. And also, planning ahead in baking, for me, just makes it more enjoyable. It makes it more fun. One of the pleasures of baked goods is that a lot of things can be made ahead. So instead of, you know, when you have a big dinner party and you have to cook the, you know, the dinner right before your guests come, with baking, you can often make the item that you want the whole day ahead and just really enjoy the process of it, and then get to reap the rewards.
Aaron, you've baked a lot of different stuff, clearly. Is there a next frontier for you? Is there the next project that you're working toward?
I've got a lot of ideas, I have to say it, but the one thing I will say, there was a distinct lack of savory baked goods in my book, The Fearless Baker, and so I would love to tackle that because those are some of my favorite things to bake at home.
I've been into making bread pudding lately, but I make a pretty very vanilla bread pudding. Any ideas on getting that a little jazzier?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could kind of add a caramel component to it if you like that vanilla flavor. You could make a simple caramel sauce. There's one in the book. And you could try that and just kind of drizzle it in right before baking, and it would continue to sort of caramelize inside. You could use vanilla bean instead of vanilla extract. That's really just an absolute flavor punch. Or try whisking some cocoa powder into it to make kind of a deep chocolate bread pudding.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it. Love hearing everyone's questions.
That was Aaron Jean McDowell. She's a baker, if you hadn't caught on, and her new book is The Fearless Baker: Simple Secrets for Baking Like a Pro. She was with us on this week's edition of Food Friday to share some of her favorite baking recipes and give us some advice. And we've got a couple of her recipes. You can find those either via the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, while you're there, let us know what you are baking, if anything, this weekend. You can also go to WPR.org/Food Friday, go straight to those recipes. And here's the secret. We keep all the recipes we talk about on Food Friday up there. So just keep scrolling. You're going to find something to make this weekend. All through the week, we've been sharing some Oscar-nominated songs and soundtracks in the run-up to Sunday's Academy Awards show, and we invited you to call in to our special call-in line and share your all-time favorite movie music. We had a taker, Tony, called into the Ideas Network line to recommend one of the most beautiful soundtracks ever. Here he is.
The soundtrack is for 1982's Conan the Barbarian, surprisingly. Very beautiful soundtrack. It has been played many, many times with symphonies in Europe. And it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous soundtrack. And you wouldn't expect that from a movie like Conan the Barbarian. But it is very, very beautiful. And it is very worth looking into and checking out.
Thanks for calling in, Tony. The composer, Basil Apollodorus, here's the Anvil of Crom from Conan the Barbarian here on Central Time.